Karen mentioned that I'm a mother. I don't know that he mentioned that we're a part of an intentional neighborhood group. And that has been a really important grounding community while I pursue ideas in my head. And I think something that unites all of us here today is the desire to be grounded followers of Christ. And so in that spirit, I certainly agree with what you're saying about the ways in which we both pursue living into the unfolding kingdom in our micro and macro ways. And probably if we're all honest with ourselves, they're all micro ways. And the most sincere witness that we give is what we're actually doing in our daily lives. So trying to be mindful and aware of that, and our intentional community has been really important in being a constant reminder of that. What I have to share with you are some ideas. I don't feel particularly well prepared, and I'm very humbled by the fact that you would applaud before I even say anything. And that's just respectful, I know, but it's a privilege, and it's very humbling to be with you today. So I will stop with the introductions, and I will launch then into some thoughts. And I realize that I actually don't have time to share with you all that I intended to as a way of a package. So I'm going to do my best, and we'll see how it goes. And I am confident that someone will remind me. That's not going to work either. If we're not doing well. So this is what we're trying to do. I've titled this Embodied Discourse as Truth Claims and Behavioral Change, which of course sounds like Yoder. And this is intended to be, to some degree, a constructive alternative or at least a complement to human rights discourse. A subtitle or a different one could be How Christ the King Churched Saved Isaac and Can Save the International Community Too. I'd like to further signal where I'm going after noting that this paper builds on Yoder's themes of the social shape of the gospel in Christendom as fitting for a conference of U.S. followers of Christ with an Anabaptist imagination, desiring to and realizing that we are occupying empire. For the nations and the Christian witness to the state signal the underpinnings of where I'm going for those familiar with Yoder's work. And in that way, this is an old Yoder paper for presentation and conversation. So to further signal where I'm going, their critique of the human rights framework by the communitarians is in tension with the desire to respond to the last and the least and the orphan and the widow, by some accounts. What I'd like to explore is the way in which being church, or living fully into the inbreaking kingdom, one, can curb violence in moments of crisis, as human rights discourse wants to do. And secondly, a thick description of prophetic hospitality and compassion and the ways that ecclesiology interacts with local situations of violence is intelligible to the international community, where rights discourse is dominant. And this is where I'll bring in the idea of using ethnography as a way of communicating these the local witness on the ground in context of protracted armed conflict. Moreover, this description of the local witness goes beyond what human rights discourse offers, and that human rights discourse often triggers prescribed responses through the liberal peace model. And I'm interested in the way that communicating the local church witness invites participation in what local communities are doing on the ground, the ways in which they are participating in the inbreaking kingdom in local communities, again, in situations of protracted armed conflict. There are two general camps on the human rights debate in ethics today. One group is satisfied with the framework established by the 1948 UN Declaration. By this account, rights discourse provides widespread recognition and perspective on realities extracted from their local contexts. All that is needed to assure responsible application is sensitivity to local cultures. The question concerning members of the first camp, concerning, that is, that concerns members of the first camp, is how to specify a universal notion in particular contexts. There's no drive to question universality. They assume that the universal is expressed in the local. There's a second camp that's suspicious of Wright's talk altogether. By their account, it is either fictitious or morally dangerous. McIntyre famously claimed that there are no such thing as rights, and belief in them is one with belief in witches and unicorns, which, of course, none of us believe. And yet he and others drawing on his critique of liberalism, and here, of course, we could draw Howard Wass into the conversation, but for simplicity's sake, I'm not going to at this moment. They stop short of proposing constructive alternatives to universal language in a complex globalized world. They don't spell out an acceptable mode of communication that is relevant to the everyday world of pragmatic necessities, as McIntyre says it in Rival Traditions. My immediate concern is political violence, or first-generation rights, due to my experience in Colombia that Aaron noted, a context of protracted intrastate conflict inflamed by U.S. intervention. If I'm sympathetic, indeed share, some of the critiques leveled by the second camp, the communitarians, do I need to choose between dangerous fiction and passivity in the face of government-sponsored violence? Must I abandon efforts to communicate concrete instances of torture, assassination, rape, and broad patterns of government subterfuge, corruption, and blatant lies? As a Christian and a U.S. citizen, I can't accept either of those options. Fortunately, it's a false choice. My thesis is that, and I see this is going really well because I'm getting to my thesis now, My thesis is that the embodied signs of the lordship of Christ in conflictive societies is intelligible locally to perpetrators of violence, and a thick description of this social shape of the gospel, Yoder, is intelligible on the world stage where human rights language is dominant. I've already referred to ethnography as a mode of communicating this witness. And I'm going to skip over some of the related questions that this brings. But I will note that how something that experience in Colombia forces me to reckon with is how might Christians in the North take more seriously the realities of groups whose plights are exacerbated by structural violence emitted from the U.S., namely our government policies, overconsumption, and our fuel-guzzling lifestyles? How do we take seriously the communities that are living into the inbreaking kingdom in situations of violence that we are fueling when there is an intentional effort to shelter us from those realities? How do we make the lengthy exposure of service workers, like Aaron and myself, and like many of you, meaningful gifts towards developing theological wisdom and conflict transformation efforts? How do we amplify the marginal church's local witness so that it can, one, witness to the church and society in the empire, and destabilize our standard complacent theology, and also invite and facilitate participation in the good news of another inbreaking kingdom enfolding amidst division and violence? How do we invite others in the international community to participate in those local efforts? I'm going to be, in talking about living into the inbreaking kingdom, and as a matter of a proper response to acknowledging that the claims that Christ's lordship makes on our lives, I want to refer to that as embodied discourse. And this is because, and I'm using the term embodied discourse as a kind of linguistic negotiation by humans in situations of violence. And I'll leave that there for a moment, but I do want to signal that I'm going to be using the notion and the framework of linguistics, and that is in particular where I will draw on Howard Wass. So We've noted that McIntyre and company are very critical of liberalism. The liberal peace is perhaps obviously a part and parcel of the liberalism that is critiqued. I'm not going to actually discuss that critique. We'll note that in After Virtue and Whose Justice and Three Rival Traditions, there's ample and very compelling critiques. And this includes the human rights framework. But McIntyre, and in the way in which Hauerwas picks it up, and Hauerwas, not to the same degree that McIntyre does, but neither grapple with the problems that I want to address, a mode of discourse that confronts specific instances of injustice in its outward shape. It seems to me that eventually the communitarian ethic needs to be pressed to speak to problems of political and military persecution that communities within the tradition they represent are dealing with. It seems as though we can have people with degrees speaking about traditions, but are the people within them only people placeholders of these traditions? And what do we do when the people who supposedly are within these traditions are not fully accounted for and by these theories? So we come back to the human rights efforts that aim to give voice to, or at least describe, what is going on in communities where protracted armed conflict is their daily bread. And the human rights language has been central to efforts to curb violence, but has required correction and reflection of people who have participated in opposing violence in political situations. Critiques subsequent to the 48 Declaration were experientially based, but even as I say, I don't find myself and my concerns addressed by McIntyre and particularly by Hauerwas, nor do I find my specific questions reflected in the various generations of human rights or the relevant experientially informed academic conversations that are going on around that same issue. In order to make sense of my experience-based questions, I want to provide a sense of the kinds of people and particular communities and violence that concerns me. I selected one story and one leader that I've worked with extensively at multiple levels in their local setting and national and international level. This story is limited in scope, but I hope it provides some insight into the kind of situation that I'm concerned that we address. I believe that it illustrates what I'm trying to argue, and that is that an embodied speech is transformative, both in the local situation, where the local community is confronting purveyors of violence or potential perpetrators of violence, and secondly, then on the international stage, potentially. So here I uplift the story of a small church in Northwest Colombia called Christ the King, apropos. We'll call this the Army Betrays and the Church Saves. The military sought to kill 32-year-old Isaac Vargas Martinez on August 5, 2009, in the northwest province of Cordoba. Long a stronghold of this illegal armed actor, the government and the armed forces often collude with the paramilitary in the region. It is the secret that everyone knows, as the locals say. When they learned of the paramilitary's effort, church leaders contacted regional authorities and the army, which was within walking distance of the threatened church member. The army, they were told, could not arrive until the following afternoon. Meanwhile, Isaac fled to a local church. Dozens of church members immediately surrounded the building and kept vigil throughout the night. They disguised and secretly accompanied him out of town, despite the watchful eye of the paramilitary, and so they were able to save the young man's life. The same kind of cruciform witness is evident in that it is a ministry and not a episodes that happen out of the blue, in that when the church pastor was threatened by the paramilitary, he and his wife, despite the fact that they have three kids, decided to stay in the region and minister to local population, continuing to resist forced displacement by the paramilitary. And they further decided to accept a position from the mayor in which Isai, the pastor, would be involved in kind of pastoral social work with the very paramilitary that were threatening his life. So this, again, it demonstrates the kind of the cruciform presence that is a challenge, let's say, particularly with those of us with children. I think we can, that, to me, is a real challenge. So in order to make this a possibility, the church members accompanied him everywhere he went, and they also slept around his around the perimeter of his home at night, just to make sure that if they killed him, they would kill all of them, as was, again, was the case with Isaac. I'm not going to provide a biographical account of the community's theological journey, but what would be relevant here would be to note a theological account of their actions and why this has worked in history. Why is it that this cruciform witness of this local community, that in their own minds, the claims of Christ compel them to put themselves between perpetrators of violence and likely victims, why this works. So this would be the part where we would talk at length about John Howard Yoder and why a vulnerable ecclesiology works as social science. So I think I'll try to name a few highlights because you know Yoder. As you know, John Howard Yoder is a theologian now associated with the New Communitarian or New Communitarian School of Thought. His ecclesiology helps to address the particular problems that arise when persecuted and persecuting parties relate. He provides building blocks for articulating an account of how Christian communities help persecuting parties wake to the recognition of wrongdoing. His contributions help explain how these communities embedded in this particular tradition's narrative may also compel a rights and news-saturated international community to an ethically motivated, compassionate response in a given setting. So at the core of the Yoder legacy, we have his ecclesiology, Church as Witness and Change. Yoder's church is a voluntary, participatory social body that claims the lordship of Christ. Thus, the church's necessary social shape is a sign and foretaste of the kingdom of God in history. Members pursue this vocation through social practices that structure the church as a contrast community before the watching world. Confession of Christ's lordship, the defining feature of the free church by Yoder's account, distinguishes belief from the world and structures belonging to both. Making the church a political body further relativizes institution of the world or structured unbelief. So here I'll just note a few features of the church and findings related to social or implications for social ethics that are particularly relevant. In body politics, we have the church practices. This is one, how we know we are church and how we live into being church. From politics of Jesus, we are familiar with, and of course, revolutionary in for our theology, and for others who are trying to pick up on Anabaptist pisciology, imitation, discipleship pattern of faithfulness to the suffering servant. Yoder posits that the church's first responsibility and gift to the world is to be church, and this means recovering the otherness of the church from the world. And then from War of the Lamb, this ecclesiology as social intervention works, according to Yoder, because it goes with the grain of the universe. Also of note for what we're doing here is the way that Yoder's ecclesiology is normatively marginal in position and is then necessarily the alternative community. And so now I'd like to come back to the notion of the church's social shape as embodied discourse, birthing new possibilities into the public realm. To the best of my knowledge, Yoder does not connect the philosophical language frameworks in his ecclesiology or the ethical implications. The themes of unity between message and medium from For the Nations and witness decisively rule out the need for a mediating language. This point is critical, and I want to hold it in tension with even the discussions of language frameworks. But I draw attention to language categories to explore how this works, the dynamics that Yoder is describing and, say, work in history. How do these work? I think language categories can be helpful. And secondly, to explore possibilities of communicating in a globalized world where the audience is far from the church's earshot and intentionally protected from their message. It's not as if they don't have a voice. It's that we can't hear it. So how do we hear? How do we hear when there are layers and very intentional obstacles in the way? For these reasons, thinking in terms of linguistic constitution, as Howard Wass proposes, helps us consider how behavior expresses ideology and how a particular Christian community interacts with the world. Howard Wass proposed the church as a mode of discourse that remembers the future through exemplifying the humanity of God. In this way, he posits a crucial relationship between being human, suffering, and the gift of speech. Linguistic constitution dissolves perceived tensions between embeddedness in a particular community narrative or inclusive humanism. It signals multiple public discourses. So now I want to speak to how being church speaks to local perpetrators as a next step, and then we'll go to how being church can speak on the international stage. So performing God's unarmed revolution as speech to the enemy. Yoder's ecclesiology is descriptive of a particular community in politically hostile environments. The church's social shape speaks volumes to the surrounding society, local authority, and of greatest interest to me at this point, potential perpetrators of direct violence. At least in this localized context, the contrast community demonstrates that the particular versus universal humanism dichotomy is a false choice. Through embodied discourse, the obedient community indicts the narrative of lies forwarded by warring factions. By refusing to accommodate false claims to lordship flaunted by armed non-state actors, or by the military, the dissident community eviscerates their claims of sovereignty and control. The illogical behavior shocks the perpetrators into recognition of shared humanity. Now, ideally, we'd go on carefully to put this experiential piece from Columbia and bake it in a Yoderian theological pan. But I don't think that we're going to have time to go through each of these steps. So I will note that in the last section we saw how saying church, as Dr. Nation says it, is an appropriate response to the claim Christ's lordship places on the lives of believers in contexts of violence. So we are now poised to explore various dimensions of the self-giving witness in hostile contexts. Let's just note here the way that there are two narratives, at least two, but for our purposes here, we'll discuss two rival narratives. There's a dominant, what wants to consider itself the dominant narrative. Here, since we're talking about a particular situation in Colombia, we have the paramilitary, which is the de facto authority in the area and is claiming sovereignty. And in this way, the armed groups, here the paramilitary, are speaking through abuse and terror. And then the counterclaim is made by the church. The embodied discourse of Christian communities confronts this narrative through its allegiance to Jesus as Lord. The church confronts the narrative of the perpetrator with its counter-narrative. Each narrative espouses a truth claim about the way things actually are. The church's yes to lordship in Christ claims implies a no to the lordship with a lowercase l. I'd like also to note that it is at this point that embodied discourse can concretely be understood as both an assertion of human dignity and a confrontation of abuse on the one hand, and participation in a tradition on the other. The claims of the community that surrounded Isaac were intelligible because they were expressed at a particular location at a particular critical time. As such, in this particular context, they defined right and wrong. Their ecclesiology plays a constitutive role in influencing what was right and wrong in their society at their time, something that rights claims intend to do. I noted earlier that when the community confronts the intentions of the armed perpetrator to kill, there is a dynamic of waking recognition. And that is something that I find helpful to explore, but we won't. Something that was relevant for me in thinking about this with my Catholic friends at Notre Dame was the way in which the Christian witness can often antagonize, particularly in a Pax Romana situation, living into the gospel, which is can be conceived as being essentially subversive, can provoke a counter response, can provoke hostilities. And explaining the ways in which the Christian witness absorbs rather than exacts violence, and why it can still be a peaceful witness and a peace community because of its response to violence, even when its embodied claim of Christ as Lord seems to result in another wave of violence, how that can still be a peace community has been something of conversation with my Catholic friends. So, I've argued for a communicative ethics that plays a constitutive role in defining what is right and wrong at crucial moments in a given society. What I have said about the communicative power of active, power-renouncing witness is in the public domain builds on Yoder's ecclesiology, and I've situated the church within the realm of public structures as one that speaks without losing its distant identity. And I recognize that you have to sort of take my word for it in light of what I've actually shared. This section focuses on the conversation between perpetrators of violence and the vulnerable community. Analyzing the Colombian case study through a lens of human behavior as communication demonstrates the salience of retelling the Christian story or embodied tradition as a mode of public discourse. And this is where I refer to it as embodied discourse. Here the language of the gospel bears the quality of the gospel as intelligible across boundaries of ethical reasoning. It was not particularistic as it spoke across conflicting lordship claims. We see that the secular or the state is not necessary to mediate between the particular and the universal. Not only does this principle not apply in the case in the Colombian context of a weak state, but in fact, a contrary claim emerges. In a near vacuum of legitimate political authority and democratic values, legal claims were vacuous, and the Christian moral language had salvific power. Calling on the state, calling on the army to somehow assert that this person had rights was empty. It required the embodied witness to actually change the dynamics of what was right and wrong in a given situation. As Yoder argues in For the Nations, to the extent to which Christian moral language is relevant to the political realm, it's relevant. In this way, the argument pushes the usual universal versus particular and universal versus relative dichotomies. In the remaining moments, I'd like to describe a two-step method for inviting participation in the life of cruciform communities resisting and opening pathways for transforming violence. The first step is to make the social shape of the gospel, in particular moments and places in history, intelligible on the international stage. The second step underscores the relevance of the active witness to a bottom-up or elicitative model of conflict transformation. And that's something that John Paul Lederach has written about, as perhaps among others. One that considers indigenous expertise as an essential resource for designing a comprehensive multilateral response to the particular crisis. Together, the steps offer a method inviting others to participate in the possibilities birthed by the local community, by the church. Tools of empirical research serve the interests of introducing the system of embodied discourse into international institutions and more generally a complex globalized world in which we live. The thick and textured description of ethnographic case studies is one such method. In the foreword to Ethnography as Christian Theology and Ethics, the editors describe the salience of ethnography to ethicists, and theologians, of course. You know, ethnography provides a way of that's actually very intentional. Ethnography provides a way of communicating lived faith and lived situations. It provides a way of accessing the messy realities of lives and contexts very different from our own. It is attentive to an embeddedness in complex power dynamics and social interests crisscrossing lived experiences. Simply stated, it provides a way to take seriously the realities of marginalized groups. And I would add, their agency in revealing sign of God's movement in history in the midst of oppression at the periphery of power. Ethnography provides a way to make lengthy exposure of service workers in different locations meaningful gifts to developing theological wisdom. Through the thick description of ethnography, the community's witness on the ground becomes their witness to us. It forces us to reflect on our culturally informed assumptions and the knowledge of experts, be they in the field of theology, ethics, or peace. Thick description of the self-giving witness here now, applying this to our particular situation, also decenters the prescriptive notions of conflict resolution model, which is, of course, associated with the human rights framework. Framing witness in moments of crisis as discourse, as we've discussed, and moving now to amplify the speech and invite others to join the witness through ethnography demonstrates the false opposition between empirical research of social science and normative theological work. I know that I'm not going to be able to prove that to you in 30 seconds that remains. So I will just name why I think this is worth mentioning. In Colombia, and then there were concrete situations in which I both communicated the realities of local communities that were victims of conflict to UN agencies, diplomats, members of Congress, and people in the pews. The abbreviations of human rights discourse was sometimes necessary to get a foot in the door, but essentially it was never as compelling as was the thick descriptions of the ways in which people were actually putting their lives on the line. The ways in which their prophetic acts of compassion and hospitality, such as what I described, actually changed dynamics and realities on the ground and redefined what was happening and what could happen. The way it opened new possibilities and new doorways and inspired imaginations on the ground. And that same recognition that I was describing between potential victim, vulnerable community, and perpetrator, that same recognition happens in very meaningful ways in describing those situations in the international community. And it is fascinating and very meaningful and a spiritually profound experience to see the way the light bulb clicks when speaking to a UN mission in the middle of New York City. And the ways in which they're automatically drawn to find ways to participate in what's already going on the ground. And this is consistent with John Paul Lederach's elicitive framework, which sees the local agents as knowledge and has a meaningful resource base, as they themselves possess ideas and notions and solutions, and that we actually can participate with them in this. This is a very different model. This is a different mode of response than what is often triggered by the human rights framework. Human rights framework would say in this situation, paramilitary, this many violations in this amount of time, these were the kinds of violations that occurred. Therefore, we look through our recipe box of prescribed responses and we will do X. It is very different from this cookie cutter model. And in this way, it's inviting participation from the international community in what is already going on the ground, the ways in which churches are responding to the inbreaking kingdom in their local contexts. So I'll skip over a lot of pages arguing that point. In theological terms, this bears resemblance to Barth's notion of looking for signs of Christ's rule in society and contributing to those signs. So I've tried here to argue for a mode of discourse that speaks to the human project in a way the second camp, those suspicious of rights talk altogether, could embrace. And Mark will tell me how well I've done. Indeed, it is grounded in their ecclesiology and insights. Yet concern for painful realities of violence and repression to which we are contributing turned the conversation from philosophy and political theology to the implications of concrete realities. In so doing, this constructive project moves beyond their reservations to bridge the gap between the work of the new communitarians and suffering communities within their traditions. If I've been at all successful, I've tried to demonstrate that it is possible for communities to make claims of right and wrong that carry moral force and awaken recognition that alters behavior in third parties. This alternative, complementary discourse does not deny individuals as a central unit. Sorry, that's another conversation I've had to have with my professors at Notre Dame. But it depends on the vulnerable community for its speech it accents. It accents the primacy of collective agency. The scandalous behavior of members together dedicated to a subversive value system, Yoder, lay claims intelligible across borders of moral reasoning. It can be harnessed to extend the participation in virtue ethics internationally by exploiting humans' linguistic constitution and sharing thick descriptions of embodied discourse. Locally and internationally, living into the Christian story and recounting these new experiences of tradition invites participation in processes of transformation. This can further nurture and the morality cultivated by the local community. The normative claims of Christ's rule and social science tracing the grain of the universe can meet.
The title of my response is Whose Discourse, Which Embodiment? Continuing a Valued Conversation Regarding a Constructive Alternative to Human Rights. What a gift it is to be invited to respond to a former student. Jana was my student in an online course 3 years ago, and she was one of those sorts of students that faculty dream of. She was a wonderful student, not only very bright and articulate, but in the midst of living in Colombia, she kept pushing and sometimes pushing back. We had many wonderful, vigorous conversations, and we've continued our conversations since then. And I hope she doesn't mind that I'm going to continue our conversation for now in front of everyone else. My desire is now to continue a conversation that I've been having with Jana off and on over the last 3 years, during and since she was in my course. What does a constructive alternative to human rights language in the light of the theologies of Yoder and Hauerwas look like? More specifically, what research does one need to engage in to do such constructive work? I affirm Jana's basic thesis. Let me repeat it. My thesis, she said, is that the embodied signs of the lordship of Christ in conflictive societies is intelligible locally to perpetrators of violence, and thick descriptions of this social shape of the gospel is intelligible on the world stage where rights language is dominant. To accomplish her alternative construction, I see her reaching in the midst of a nest of complex issues for ways to hold all of this together that A, has Anabaptist theological integrity, B, deals honestly with the complex realities of lives lived in worlds riddled with violence and suffering, C, could potentially have some influence within the same political worlds now held captive to the language of rights, and thus D, a form of communication that could potentially lessen the violence inflicted in such situations. If I have named this correctly, again, I affirm the effort. Moreover, as she knows, certainly I affirm acquiring theological sensibilities from John Howard Yoder. Everybody I know will be surprised by that, but I do. Then I want to say, if I were doing this research, I would want to discern which writers, which approaches to employ by repeatedly asking whose discourse is being employed, that is, what philosophy or theology is underwriting a particular approach, which embodiment is being named, and what are the sources for naming the embodiment in this way. Our first community as Christians is the church. How does the method employed relate to the convictions, the ethics, the life of this community as our lives are located within this community relate to the pressing issues of violence in the context of a particular culture? To be clear, I am asking these questions. Asking these questions is related not only to a discernment regarding particular theological writings. That's the more obvious task. So let me begin again. To be clear, asking these questions is related not only to a discernment regarding particular theological writings to employ, but also to employ deep theological sensibilities for the purposes of discerning which other disciplinary theories and particular writings might be useful or, on the other hand, counterproductive. So a few brief suggestions as Jana and I continue our conversation. These are steps I would take if I were undertaking her research program. First, I would want to have a thick account of a McIntyre-type critique of the language of rights, which you didn't present in the paper. McIntyre, as she said, has famously said that belief in rights is one which is one with belief in witches and in unicorns. What he means to signal by this provocative statement is that, contrary to the myth, human rights language is not some sort of universal, neutral language. It's a language with a history that one can narrate. It's embedded in a tradition. So it is a particular kind of language that arose in the modern world. So it's one particular language along with other particular languages that are available. That's what he wants to name by using this provocative statement. Maybe this thick account of human rights can be acquired from McIntyre himself. Certainly there are signals embedded in After Virtue and Whose Justice, Which Rationality, and I would want to pay attention, very serious attention, to those signals. And he does have at least one essay on human rights that I was able to find. However, in relation to human rights specifically, I might look elsewhere. Ronald Beiner, for instance, I think a Marxist political scientist, in the first 97 pages of his book, What's the Matter with Liberalism, has a very interesting and I think instructive account of what's the matter with liberalism by employing an Aristotelian critique quite consistent with McIntyre's. He concludes these 97 pages with the chapter, The Language of Rights and the Language of Good. It seems to me that's not a bad place to start. I was helped years ago by reading the short book by Michael Walzer called Thick and Thin, Moral Arguments at Home and Abroad. Michael Walzer claims that, contrary to what many people seem to claim, that the language of justice always gets its thick understanding from particular local communities. It is the case that on particular occasions, like occupying movements in, say, New York, that people can come together and protest in general and have placards that are more or less consistent with each other and maybe calling for specific changes that they all agree about. But if one scratches below the surface, their understanding of justice is a thick understanding that is rooted in their home convictional communities, and they would differ significantly on a number of issues. Often we forget that, but Walzer doesn't want us to forget it. McIntyre, certainly in giving his long historical account of varied understandings of justice, doesn't want us to forget it. Walter Brueggemann, in drawing on the Old Testament, has said that one of the images perhaps we need to think about is that the ancient Israelites, when they wanted to negotiate with non-Israelites, had to learn a second language and negotiate at the wall, but they always needed to remember their first language, not meaning, of course, just Hebrew, but their first convictional language. Who were they when they were negotiating at the wall with those who were not a part of the people of Israel? One of the people I read regularly to remind me that there's no such thing as some sort of generic universal language is Stanley Fish. I think he's very therapeutic. His essay, Liberalism Doesn't Exist, is wonderful. His book, which amplifies that claim, there's no such thing as, The Trouble with Principles, also there's no such thing as free speech. All of those remind us that there's no such thing as universal, neutral language called human rights. Also, as Brad was sort of alluding to, my friend Brad Kallenberg has written a wonderful book called Ethics as Grammar, which is about an account of Hauerwas and Wittgenstein, showing with Hauerwas how he has employed Wittgensteinian understandings of language to remind us that all moral language is integrated into a way of life. Of course that's true. When you read the book, you see that, of course, it's true. There's a more recent book by Mark Ryan called The Politics of Practical Reason, which uses another philosopher that Hauerwas has drawn from to show something similar. Practical reasoning is always done within particular context. And in that book in particular, Mark Ryan is debating some of the critics of Hauerwas on the subject of justice. So there are at least three things I would want to get from a thick reading of Alastair McIntyre. First, there is no such thing as neutral universal languages, like human rights. Second, a thick account of the Christian community in light of McIntyre reminds us that, yes, the Christian community, like any other community, has virtues that are formed that make character, there are habits involved, there's a way to name this, there's a history that it has, there's a community that's located in that history, and we need to name all of that, which really Jana was alluding to by the way she was talking about describing the particulars of the abuses in Colombia. But I think actually, theoretically, McIntyre is very helpful with that. Now, he doesn't focus a lot on giving thick accounts of the vices, but obviously the same thing is true. So if you're trying to name what's gone wrong and how people are abusing other people, what vices are at work, how do you narrate that, how do you give an account of what's going on when people are being murdered in Colombia? There's a history. I also would draw from Stanley Hauerwas much more thickly than you at least signal that you would, because Hauerwas in many writings is very helpful, and as it happens in his most recent book, War and the American Difference, he has at least four essays that I'm sure would be quite useful for what you're wanting to do, one of which was originally given in 2008 in Oxford as an Amnesty International lecture. So undoubtedly it has some relevance for thinking about human rights. One of the things I often feel when I read Hauerwas on justice or on human rights is related to an anecdote I love about Igor Stravinsky, a composer. He once composed a piece for an orchestra, and some of the violinists told him that the passage he had written, this one passage he had written for the violinist, was too difficult to play. It is impossible, they said to him, and he responded by saying, "I understand that. What I am after is the sound of someone trying to play it." That's what Hauerwas keeps trying to do with justice and human rights. It is difficult theologically to reflect on abstractions like rights and justice. And Hauerwas has reminded us of the multiple layers of meaning, the way in which traditions inform this language, the way in which it's rooted in a way of life, and he keeps reaching for how to name it, and for my satisfaction at least, doesn't quite make it, but at least he's trying to play it. And he's always, because he's a voracious reader, in his footnotes, he's always pointing us to places where we could look. So that's all of that is under point number one. Second, that getting a thicker account from McIntyre. Second, I would name a thicker account of Yoder's Christology, ecclesiology, and his understanding of how Christians and the church relate to the larger culture. I've believed very strongly in recent years, particularly, that Yoder's claim that the church's responsibility to and for the world is first and always to be the church has huge importance, an importance that's rarely fully understood. The temptation is, and I fear, I sense it present in your paper, Jana, is to use Christology and ecclesiology mostly as a means to an end. It's obvious we're naming them so that we can do things we want to do. But the church is first and foremost about worshiping God. And that doesn't have any real purpose or use. It's related to what was being said earlier by Bethany about art, in a way. Worshiping God is for its own sake. And then, as Karl Barth reminds us repeatedly, worshiping God for his own sake entails a life of faithfulness. It entails a life of witness. And thus, we do live in the kinds of ways that Jana is naming. But we need to get clear about how we name ecclesiology and Christology in relation to that. I've tried to name this in a variety of essays, one or two that have been published perhaps since the last time we emailed each other, Jana. But really, the best way to get at this now is by reading some writings by Branson Parler. Branson Parler is a young Yoder scholar. He has a long review of a new book by Paul Martins called The Heterodox Yoder, a 39-page review, which is wonderful. And it's leading up to his forthcoming book, which is called Things Hold Together, John Howard Yoder's Trinitarian Theology of Culture. It is a wonderful book, and it shows us a very thick theological understanding of Yoder's way of talking about how Christ and the church relate to the larger world. I'll skip the next short paragraph, I think. Yes, I will. So third and finally, I deeply resonate with the instinct for choosing to lean toward a book that suggests its authors are linking ethnographic studies with theology and ethics. The instinct, as I see it, is to make sure this discussion of a constructive alternative to human rights stays rooted in reality, and especially the realities of a world too often riddled with violence and suffering. At this point, I want to say my mantra, however, whose discourse, which embodiment? Isn't it the case that McIntyre and Hauerwas already have an approach that is rooted in concrete life, at least theoretically? That's why Hauerwas, for instance, edited a book called Why Narrative? It's what the virtue tradition is about. So I'm not sure you need ethnographic studies in relation to that or in addition to that. Perhaps there are writings more closely related to the project of McIntyre and Hauerwas, and thus Yoder, in ways that would be very helpful for what you want to do. In fact, perhaps writings by people deeply influenced by Hauerwas would be directly helpful. Related to Latin America, I think immediately of William Kavanaugh's book, Torture and Eucharist, and Daniel Bell's book, Liberation Theology After the End of History. And I do believe that there are things to learn from these authors and these particular books that are very helpful. However, from my perspective, for purposes of clarifying some of the issues, I think I would use the horrendous realities related to the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, wherein more than 300,000 Rwandans were killed by fellow Rwandans in less than 100 days. There are many books describing the situation, and as it happens, there is a Ugandan theologian, Emmanuel Katangala, who wrote his doctoral thesis on Hauerwas' ethics, who has written a very illuminating book on the Rwandan genocide called Mirror to the Church. An extraordinary and painful book, but very instructive book. And of course, as is obvious from the title, though he's trying to narrate what went wrong, what happened, the viciousness, the vices that were realities within Rwanda, it's also a book that's intended to be a mirror to the church in the U.S., the church in Colombia, the church in various places. And then, of course, the particulars vary from context to context. But we need that kind of specific narration by a theologian who knows the writings of Hauerwas. Finally, I'll end on a personal comment. Jana can't know, although maybe I said it in my online course, I don't know. These issues mattered a great deal to me for a variety of reasons. I'm married to a woman who lived in South Central Los Angeles for 18 years. And although many people, many Americans, are not aware of it, in any given two-year period in which my wife lived in South Central Los Angeles, there were more people murdered in Los Angeles than in the whole history of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. It was a civil war, and she was right in the middle of it. She has enough stories. I've heard so many stories from her. I care about how such violence can be transformed into redemptive situations. I'm currently finishing a book on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I've studied the Nazi era for some time. It was probably the Holocaust that led up to the formulation of the Universal Rights in 1948, more than likely. Bonhoeffer didn't have to employ the language of rights to challenge what was being done to the Jews already in 1933. He knew how to name it because he was a Christian, he was a theologian, and he knew it had to be denounced. We can use particularistic Christian language through narration, through theological proclamations. Thank you.